Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk some more about caregiving. I'm spending a lot of time on caregiving because I wager that everybody listening to this program could be categorized either as a patient or a caregiver. And if you aren't at this moment, you either have been or will be a patient or a caregiver. Sometimes you're both at the same time, and that presents some interesting challenges of its own. But I thought we should share a number of stories because it's easier to see the issues in someone else's experience than it is to see them in your own experience. So today you're going to meet two more people who are caregivers, June and Jim. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. June is 90 years old. She is the primary caregiver for her husband, who is 89 and 3/4. He'll be 90 in May. And she has been now for many years, most intensely in the last 1 year. But it's an ongoing situation. And as usual with a caregiving situation, it's uncertain just how long this is going to go on. So there are a couple of things that I want you to focus on as you listen to these interviews. Let's talk about compliance, attitude, and negotiation. And these are three very important interpersonal characteristics, and they're governed both by the patient and by the caregiver. Compliance is a characteristic of the patient. How compliant is the patient? When you ask the patient to do something, how willing is that patient to do it? Or how much do they defy? And when we talked with Margaret the other day, you heard that her mother-in-law is somewhat defiant and always works to not do what she's asked to do. And that presents tremendous challenges for the people who are trying to care for her. Attitude on the part of both the patient and the caregiver, the way you approach the situation, your feelings about whether you feel put upon, whether you feel angry, both as a patient and as a caregiver, that attitude counts a great deal and will color the relationship and make it easier or harder for both people in the situation. Negotiation. We heard from Nancy a few weeks ago that she was able to negotiate with her parents, but as she said, fortunately they had all their marbles. It's not always possible to negotiate with a person. The person may be unconscious or unable to speak and negotiate, or mentally unable to negotiate. So it's often hard to determine what the patient would like to have and whether that's possible, and what's needed for their medical care, and whether the patient is willing to comply with the medical directions. It's all very tricky, and there are no easy answers here. So let's listen in to a conversation I had with June about taking care of Harry. You always say that you married your high school sweetheart.
Oh, indeed I did. I knew him 10 years before I married him. That's not so much that it took so long to know what we wanted to do, but we did have to go to college first. And
so you were 15?
We were 13 when we first knew each other.
Yeah.
And we did go together for 3 years in high school, but then he went to college in Michigan and I went to college in Pennsylvania, and saw him only when he came to Williamsport to visit his grandparents.
And you got married in 1941.
That is correct. And had that was 6 months before we entered World War II. And We've had a wonderful life, so that I can't fuss too much about what's happened now, because we've had many, many blessings for a long, long time. And, of course, Daddy took wonderful care of me all those many years, so now it's my turn to take care of Daddy.
So you first started noticing some decline 5 or 6 years ago.
He was asked something down at the zoo and gave an answer that wasn't quite right.
And as background, he's a PhD in comparative zoology, taught anatomy for 35 years, and in his retirement, 40 years, and in his retirement was a docent at the Memphis Zoo.
Right.
So,
and very, very knowledgeable about all the animals. Sally said, you have never been to the zoo unless you've gone with Harry, because he will tell you something about every animal that you cannot read on the signs. And he made it very, very interesting. Well, when John Sewell came, he went down to the zoo for a trip with us, and Harry wasn't quite as sharp as he had always been in the past. And then another time, when one of the docents asked him a question, he didn't come out with the kind of an answer that was typical of him. And so I began to wonder, but I never thought we would be in the situation we're in today.
Right.
That was the farthest thing from my mind.
Right. And I remember that you approached the doctor a couple of times and said, you know, I don't think he's quite as sharp as he used to be. And the doctors really didn't acknowledge it for a long time.
I don't think he wanted to recognize it either. But
I think my impression was that half the doctors in this town were my father's students, right? And they were so in awe of him, that including his own physician, that he would go to the doctor and the doctor would say, oh, how are you, Dr. Wilcox? And he'd just start having a one-way conversation, and Daddy would smile and nod in the right places, The doctor thought he was having a conversation with him, and he didn't realize it was one way. I remember you had to have some surgery yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Not very serious surgery, but nothing is minor when you're, what were you, 87 or something, 88?
Well, I asked my doctor to whom I should go for this parathyroid thing, and I said to him, is this the doctor you'd send your mother to? And he said, absolutely. I said, okay, then I'll go.
At that point, clearly Dad was not as responsive as he had been. But we were all expecting he was going to get better. And then
exactly.
I think that was about the time that we did get the doctor to send someone over to do an evaluation. And I remember sitting with you while the nurse was asking him questions. And at one point she said to him, now if something's wrong and you need to call for help, what's the telephone number that you dial? And he didn't know the answer. And I looked at you and you looked at me, and that we were both stunned. And that was really the first time that we'd had a clear indication that things were just not clicking right in his brain.
Well, I never really had a diagnosis until we were at Alan Morgan.
A nursing home,
The nursing home. And I said to the doctor, what is this diagnosis? And he said, well, he has a dementia, and I think he might have some Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's being a form of dementia.
Right, but there are a number of things that can keep your brain from clicking right.
When I knew he didn't want to read most foreign languages, it didn't bother me. When he didn't want to read German, which was probably his strongest foreign language, that surprised me. And he had always been so happy to help Father Veron with the Greek course, and he didn't want to read Greek anymore.
Right. So the foreign languages went first, but we didn't think much of that.
No. And then for a while he was reading a book a day. And we'd go to the library often. And then he got so that he didn't read. He hasn't read in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. One time he asked me not long ago to see the paper, and I handed it to him. And he didn't read it. But it's very difficult to see a very bright man lose it.
Right. And your sweetheart and your partner become your dependent in a certain way.
Yeah, that's true. But Daddy always took good care of me, so it's my turn to take care of Daddy.
Yeah.
Daddy was a fine, fine man. And we were blessed to have him in our lives.
Now, the support that you get is from where?
I get marvelous support from my children. Joyce lives a long way away, but she does a wealth of things when she comes. And she keeps in touch with the telephone. Margaret and Jim live closer, and we'll do anything that I need. Jim often comes on Sunday morning, which allows me to go to church, and if I can, I'll stop at the store on the way home. But sometimes he's busy and can't do that, and then Margaret shops for me.
Yeah. And you have a number of friends who've been through similar experiences.
I have a friend who will bring my friends who are older than I and two are younger every Monday, and they come and we have dessert. They take turns bringing dessert, and then we'll play bridge. And so that's my day away from home at home.
So they all come to you so that you don't have to leave Daddy.
That's right. They come here. We used to take turns going to people's houses, but I can't leave, and they know that, so they always come here.
And they're all widows now, right?
Everybody's widowed but me.
We were counting up the other day. The anatomist that I remember from that anatomy group when I was growing up, there were about 10 of them, and of that group, 5 of them have had dementia. And I guess that's that 50% of people 80, but that's really pretty scary.
That I'm sure the anatomists don't want to make that ratio correct, but I'm afraid they have.
Makes you wonder about formalin.
It certainly does. It certainly does.
Because when we used to visit the anatomy building, it just reeked of formalin.
Well, some people come up with that as a possibility.
Yeah.
I also wondered, Harry was very close to Hiroshima and Nagasaki when they were shortly after the bombs went off.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if anything in his experience in the war had anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I have known his family and mine for several generations, and to the best of our knowledge, nobody has had dementia. So maybe if they'd lived longer, they might have had, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But his great-grandparents celebrated their golden wedding before the turn of the century, and that being the 20th century. So that's really, they mm-hmm. lived to be quite elderly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you went to an Alzheimer's support group at one point yourself, right?
I went to a one-day conference that I thought was very helpful. Most of the things didn't apply to me because I had already solved those problems. For example, Harry does not walk. Therefore, I don't need to worry about his walking off anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people were, well, everybody was younger than I because I'm 90. And I've been married 66 years, knew my husband 10 years before that. I don't know of anybody that had been married even 60 years that was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that my support group and that my religious faith were two very great factors that a lot of people didn't have.
We're talking with June, a 90-year-old caregiver for her husband, Harry, who is almost 90 himself. And we're going to be back after this break to talk with June some more and also with her son, Jim. And we have a surprise for you. See if you have figured out who June is. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now and we'll be right back. We're back talking some more with June, who's a 90-year-old caregiver for her husband, Harry. And if you haven't figured it out by now, June happens to be my mother, and Jim is my brother, and Margaret, that you met a couple weeks ago, is my sister. So the three of us are the children of June and Harry. And as my mother just said, it's a team effort, all three of us, children and my mother, working together to take care of Dad. It's not an easy project. Much of the burden falls on her. She is keeping him in her home with the help of hospice, and the three of us pitch in as we can around our own busy lives. My sister lives within 20 minutes of them, my brother lives 40 minutes away, and I live 1,200 miles away, so mostly I'm there by telephone, internet. I'm the internet shopping guru to help find ways to solve tricky problems. But we're all working as a team, which feels very, very good. And the first bit of advice I would have for any family going through this is make peace with one another, support one another, and find ways that you can all agree that you can use each other's strengths. Work out a way that you can all be friends and be supportive of one another and keep peace amongst you, because you're going to need that total power applied to the problem. You don't need to create more interpersonal problems amongst yourselves. So let's go back and talk some more with June about the advice that she would give to people going through a similar situation. If you were talking with someone else who was in the same pickle, what words of wisdom would you want to share with them about how to not only take care of their loved one, but also take care of themselves?
The physical therapist up at Alan Morgan told me that I should not even try to lift Daddy, and he's so much heavier than I, that I do not try to lift him. And I think that's one way in which I take care of myself. Mm-hmm. But I don't worry about myself. I never have, and that's not a part of my thinking. But I did advise a friend of mine who has this problem to allow, she said, well, she has one child and a mate who lives not too far from her, but she said, I don't like to call on them because they both work. And I think that's a mistake, because I think the children need to help their parents. It's a part of life, and they want to, and they should not be denied the opportunity.
Right.
To do that. And it would help the mother as well as help the children accept the problem with the father.
Mm-hmm. And that there's a decline happening, and they need to understand that.
Uh-huh.
If you keep them, sort of shield them from it, then they won't appreciate as much what their parents are going through.
Well, and it's a team effort.
Yes.
And I have felt that the children and I are a team, and I would like her to feel that her children are helping her, that they are a team, that this is a family project, mm-hmm. and not a solo.
One of the things that, because I've been a caregiver too, as you know.
Yes.
And one of the things I remind people is, you know, on the airline, they always say, you know, when those little masks come down, mm-hmm. the oxygen masks, put your own mask on first.
That's right.
And then help the other person. Mm-hmm. Because if you pass out, you're not going to be any good to anybody.
That's true.
So in order to be a good caregiver, you have to take good care of yourself. And I know you don't put much thought about it, but my brother and sister and I worry about you.
Well, there are several things I do try to do. I do try to take my shower, and I try to get enough sleep. Mm-hmm. I can't always go to bed when he goes to bed, but I try to plan to get enough sleep. And I try to read my Bible and get close to God every day.
Right. And you, you still read? You're part of a book club? Are you still part of your book club?
No.
Not anymore?
I dropped all of my associations with various groups. The children say, oh, well, now tell me when it is and I'll come. But unless it's extremely important, I don't do it. I'm thinking very seriously about planning to go to a party for my ex-principal, who is going to be 90 the last of November. She's catching up to me. And that'll be a party with all of the retired teachers that I worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that time suits either Margaret or Jim, I will go. Otherwise, I will just write a note.
Mm-hmm.
But normally, for things that happen once a month, I just skip them.
But the bridge game on Mondays is sacrosanct.
The bridge game on Monday that comes here,
that's right,
is a different story.
Yeah, that's Mama's Day Out.
That's Mama's Day Out at home.
Right.
And I think that's important. And everybody has told me, the chaplain and the nurse and the aides, that that's very important and that I should keep that up.
Right.
And I think Daddy enjoys it too, because he enjoys the girls coming to say hello to him.
Right.
And these are people that he has known for 50 years or more. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's just somebody new or somebody that he didn't know very
right.
well.
Right. And you've redesigned many things in the house in order to accommodate his needs as they changed.
Well, a house, you should not be the servant of the house. The house should be the servant of the people.
Right.
So that's just an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most dramatic was when Jimmy reduced the height of our bed. We have an antique bed, and he lowered it. And so that reduced the chance of a fall. But now Daddy is in a hospital bed, and I'm in a single bed next to him. And the double bed is out at Margaret's house.
Well, one of the things I thought you and Jim did very well is to design that room so that the look of the room really didn't change a whole lot.
No.
And he's in the same position he was before, in order not to disorient him.
Yes, you just don't want to disorient him at all.
Right.
Or do anything that might agitate him.
Right. And the other thing is that you really kept him in the center of all the activity in the house. He comes out and stays in the den, which is the center of activity, and people come in and talk to him and around him. So he's really right in the center of activity.
A part of the life of the house.
Right.
Well, that's why I don't want him in bed.
Yeah.
Even though he can't get up without help, it's worth it to me to pay somebody, which I have to do in order to put him to bed, to have him a part of the life of the house.
Right. So you have someone who comes in, gets him up in the morning, puts him in his chair in the den, and then another person comes in the evening and puts him to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But that way he's able to be with the activity of the house and then go get a good night's sleep.
Another thing we did, because we have both been readers, we have never had cable television. But because we don't read, now I have cable television, and he has found that very interesting.
I remember Jim said that when you realized Daddy was watching the soaps in the middle of the day, you said, that's it, and you got cable TV.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you could watch the History Channel and the Animal
Discovery
Channel and stuff.
Channel and yeah. Animals and and Matlock.
Things much more stimulating. Yeah.
Sometimes he doesn't watch, but I think he watches enough and kind of a little noise in the house that mm-hmm. it makes it a part of life.
Right. And I frankly noticed this time, this visit, he's much more responsive than he has been for the last year or two.
Well, yeah. I
think it's measurable in inches, obviously, but it's perceptibly better.
It may be better for a while, but in the long-term viewpoint, it's not better.
No, I realize.
Yeah. No, it's not like but he's we'll getting well. But what I meant to say is I think you're doing a great job and keeping his mind stimulated so that it can do the best it can do.
That's what the chaplain has said, too, which, and the nurse has told me that. I certainly want to do the very best I can do. And maybe I learned something from having Grandma Wilcox with us for 9 years. I don't know.
Your mother-in-law. She lived the last 9 years of her life in your house.
But we kept her happy, I think, reasonably so.
Yeah.
Of course she wanted to be in her own house, but when the choice was here or a nursing home, it was easy to make that choice. Right. Having tried the nursing home.
Yeah. Well, and part of his latest decline was when he went to the hospital. They tied him in bed and gave him drugs to keep him from walking the halls because from their perspective, he was a problem patient. He wanted to leave, and he was not totally with it, so it was not right for him to go out. But their solution was to tie him down and give him some sort of drugs to keep him quiet. But that the 5 days that he spent tied to the bed and drugged reduced his muscle mass, reduced his function enormously.
It certainly did. Now, the nursing home people had different laws, and so they solved their problem in a different way. One was to lower the bed at night so that should he fall out, it wouldn't fall very far.
Somebody told me, too, that in the nursing homes, they sometimes will put the bed all the way down, not only because they have less distance to fall, but also because older people have a hard time getting up from something that's very low down.
That's true.
So they might not be able to get out of bed.
Well, that's another way to solve a big problem.
Well, it's certainly better than drugs.
Well, drugs in older people aren't very... he's taking very, very little medicine now. Probably less medicine than he's taken in years. And in smaller doses. But his Coumadin has to be regulated.
So now with the hospice service that you have going on right now, the nurse comes in once a week and checks it twice a week?
Usually twice a week. I have 5 mornings a week if we don't have a holiday. Then we have a social worker who comes once a month near the end of the month. And we have a chaplain who comes usually once a week. And I'm very grateful for all those services.
The nurse, was like she brought the flu shot today. That mm-hmm. was nice.
We've always had our flu shots mm-hmm. because of the fact that we were teachers and always with kids. But I had one so that I wouldn't be sick for him.
Right.
And I don't think it hurt him to have it either.
Right. None of us wants to get the flu.
No.
Yeah, everybody in my house has gotten them too. Because we have somebody in the house who has a kidney transplant. So we all want to make sure we don't get the flu ourselves and bring it home and create a bigger problem there. That's one of those parts of taking care of the caregivers as well as the primary person.
Well, that's true. That's
yeah.
true.
Great.
I think some people worry about the caregiver needs to get out. I have never felt that I needed to get away, but a lot of people do, and they shouldn't be faulted if they feel that way. For instance, my brother.
Mm-hmm.
There just comes a time when he's just got to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And so his wife, who is sick, goes to visit the daughter, and he goes with one of his sons skiing or bicycling or hiking or whatever the season may bring, in spite of his age of, what is he, 84 now?
Yeah, he's a
pretty
spry 84.
But he just has to get away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a woman is more used to doing the things that are needed when you have a sick spouse.
But some women may need to get away too, and I think you're right. That
they shouldn't feel badly,
right.
And they should plan that, because when they come back, they're more interested. They have something to tell them that's different.
Right.
And so I don't want anybody to feel... But I have not felt truly, maybe it's having those girls come on Monday, but I have not felt the need that I've just got to get away.
But the activities, I've noticed your activities have changed. As you said, you used to do a lot of reading, a lot of writing. Now you're doing a lot of crocheting. I came and you said, I made a couple of afghans, and I looked over and there's a stack of a dozen afghans in there.
I think there's only 10 waiting to be delivered, but I'm working on 2 right now.
But you can sit here and crochet with Daddy.
I have to keep my hands busy.
Yeah.
I want to be with him, and he wants me to be with him, even though he doesn't talk very much. But he knows I'm here, and mm-hmm. I'll put my hand over and pat him a little bit, and that seems to be a very comforting thing.
Yeah.
And so I sit here and crochet, mm-hmm. and whereas if I were trying to read, I couldn't think about him and whatever it was I'm reading. So it's easier for me to crochet.
Right.
I do the same pattern in a variety of colors. I like the pattern, and it's very easy to do, and I have to. And so I have made for all of my grandchildren at least one, sometimes 2 for each one, and mm-hmm. I've made for at least one for all of my great-grandchildren. Yeah. My parents had 21 grandchildren, and they're 42 in the next generation, so I have a few more people to work for.
You have a list to work off of. Well, I think you've done a great job, and I think it's made a very big difference for him to have him close to the activity and close to you. And he definitely does respond to you and is calmed by you in a way that he is not calmed by anybody else.
Well, I think he's a little better than he was in January and February.
Definitely.
And I think the fact that when Jimmy and I told him that he was coming home, I think he realized that. Mm-hmm. And I think home still means something to him.
For sure.
Yeah, I don't look forward to the time when it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But if that comes, well, we've been able to lick a lot of other problems in our life. We'll lick that one too.
That's right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're just very welcome.
I appreciate you sharing these thoughts.
I hope it helps somebody.
Thank you.
We're speaking with June. June was a teacher her whole life, and she still is a teacher today, teaching us as she learns about taking care of Harry. Stay tuned with us. We're going to talk with her son, Jim, about his role in caregiving for his father. Let's take a little break here. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service of the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Family Alliance. Please come to the website and read all about us at powerfulpatient.org. You'll find this program and previous programs there, along with the program guides that expand more on the topics that we've been covering here, with information about the people we've spoken with. Please join us at powerfulpatient.org. Wondering if I could ask you some questions about your role as a caregiver. What motivates you as a caregiver? The majority of caregivers in the United States are women, like 30% of them are men. Tell me some of your feelings about being a caregiver.
Well, I think there is a responsibility of a child back to their parents for what they've done for you in the past, but I think more importantly, it's just got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do it, who will? And the alternative for professional outside the home care is very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically for, I think, the majority of people, cost prohibitive. But it's not an economical decision that I'm looking at. It's just what's best for my mother, which, you know, who is still alive and alert and coherent and knows what's going on and is helpful to make great decisions, and what's best for her.
Yeah.
She wants her lifelong partner. You know, and you know how long they've been together, since they were teenagers, and now they're 90 years old. So, you know, she wants him there. She wants him home.
Right.
And it's easier on her to have him at home. And so whatever it takes basically to make her happy and to keep that relationship as good as it can be, that's what has to be done, you know. And we did a short term in the a nursing home environment, hoping to get some positive results and some rehab and maybe getting back to where he could be more independent. And in that 2 month period of time, there was an additional card on the table that we had to worry about, and that was her transportation, whether she drove herself or somebody had to pick her up and take her over to the nursing home for a daily visit. And she would sit there from breakfast to dinner basically with him, and then we had to get her back home. And whether we were providing that transportation or worrying about her driving at age 90 during or just before rush hour traffic wasn't the best option. It's just as time consuming to go in a system in the morning and the evening at their home as it is to go back and forth to the nursing home for transportation. So those equaled out. But I really think it's the love and respect that you have for your parents, primarily the guy that needs the help, and in my case, it's my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's the love and respect of mom, who certainly is more visually more aware of what's going on than dad is. Dad, I think, understands what's going on. He certainly gives me some appropriate responses from time to time. But sometimes he's confused. He doesn't know who I am or what I'm there for.
Mm-hmm.
Just this past weekend, he asked me, how long have I known her, referring to my mom. Well, I've known her, or at least she's known me, since she was 36 years old, and she's now 90. So that mm-hmm. says that I'm 55. You know, or soon to be 55.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 35 when I was born. So it's, you know, he's known me for 55 years. How
right.
long have I known him? I guess that long, but, you know, you don't remember the first few years of your life. I know that he took care of me when I needed to be taken care of. I remember days when I was a teenager and I was sick and made a mess of things in the bathroom. He came in and cleaned it up just like, and nothing was ever said.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like you're sick and you can't help this, Montezuma's revenge.
Right.
And so it's payback time. I mean, there's days that you go in and you have to clean the man up from head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's wiggled out of his diaper. You don't get mad. You don't, because you're going to go bouncing around and like any other stressful situation, bouncing off the walls and getting mad ain't going to do any good. You know, you're going to be right back where you started from, and you still got to make the right decision when you calm down. So you mm-hmm. don't get mad at him. And there's been times that he's been a little irritated and hard to deal with. You just got to calm him down the best you can and keep on going.
What would you say is the biggest difficulty in dealing with this situation?
Wow. In my case, My father was a brilliant mind, and to see a man that could literally go through two very thick books a week, a man that could speak so many foreign languages and translated so many foreign medical journals, and he was truly one of the most notable men in his profession. To see him now not knowing what day it is, not knowing who I am,
mm-hmm.
from time to time not knowing my mother, it's hard.
Sure. And it hurts her too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But you have to understand that you're doing the best you can do.
Right. I've been looking at how the dynamics in the family evolve over time, that you go from being the child to, in a sense, being a parent.
tell me your thoughts about that.
Well, you know, when you have your parents grow old and they grow more dependent on you, it's just one more responsibility that you absorb as you mature.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we are blessed that we have had our parents for so long, and you deal with people whose life not necessarily would reach half of what their life has been.
Right.
And, I mean, growing old's hard, but the alternative is difficult, too.
Sure.
I think it's, you want to make the person as peaceful and as comfortable as they possibly can be. You want to take care of the caregiver as much as you possibly can. You want to accomplish those things in life that are reasonable to accomplish. And you want to pass on the values of life as best you can pass those on. Other than that, and you well know that life sometimes is reduced to a mere paragraph from a genealogical point of view. 200 and 300 years ago, you might read about an ancestor that really accomplished a lot. You might read about another ancestor that was merely a farmer in the hills of the great state of wherever, and he's reduced to just a paragraph. But what is important is the life values that he passed on to his children, and they pass on to their children. So I think one of the most important things is perhaps the value of the lesson that my kids are going to get from them seeing me do what I do, and certainly that my sisters do for our parents. And that is, hey, we take care of our parents when they need help. As they should understand, we try to take care of our children as they need help.
Right.
And we just keep passing it on from generation one to the next. And that's the most valuable thing, is just pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take the material stuff with you. You can't take the love with you. You got to pass it on. Some people may be shallow and look at it from a point of view of pure dollars and cents, or shallowness that it is interfering with their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It is confining. You don't get to just go out and do things like you normally would want to do. It's hard to plan to go out of town. It's hard to plan to go and do anything long term. You can't get overly involved in other activities that may require a set routine or ritual, because you know that every evening at 6:30 or 7 o'clock at night, you got to go and do your routine chores.
Right.
Of putting a man to bed.
Right.
You know. And in one regard, I'm very, very lucky. Because my assistance is basically needed in the morning and in the evening, and sometimes not every day, and that's thankful, because I've got some other help. And I don't have to sit there. I'm not confined to 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's still able to get around, fix lunch, and sit there and do her crochet, and she can produce an Aspen in about 2 to 2.5 weeks. and it looks like a machine over there. She doesn't miss a beat in her conversation. She's just able to keep on making stitches and doing beautiful handcraft work.
Right.
That's probably how she passes the time, and I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. So your primary goals are not only to keep your father as comfortable as you possibly can, but also to support your mother.
Yeah, I had a good friend, and she said that you have to take care of the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
That you really got to protect that one. And she had been down the long haul. And I think she understood that it's sometimes hardest on those that are there providing them the help. Because they see the daily decline. Their activity is reduced. I know my mother says she wishes she could get out and walk more.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of those mall walkers years ago
mm-hmm.
that would put on her tennis shoes and drive over to the nearby shopping mall and at 7:30, 9 o'clock in the morning be out there with a half a dozen others and be walking a couple of miles inside the mall. Well, she had to change her routine and now she doesn't want to leave the house and, mm-hmm. and go do those activities. So she's reduced her activities. I think it affects all of the people around someone in different ways. But that's mm-hmm. how it's affected her.
What would you say are the biggest benefits of the work you've been doing with them?
Making my mom happy. If you can keep if you keep your mother happy and keep your father happy, that's the reward.
Yeah.
As a father of five girls,
mm-hmm.
I know that if they keep me happy, I'm happy. And they're happy about it. And if I can keep my parents happy, that's the greatest reward. I wasn't the most studious child in high school nor in college. In one year, I actually buckled down and hit the books and did pretty good, made Dean's List, and my dad thought it was a fraternity joke. When they got the letter at home. Well, he was happy and he was proud of my good grades. First time he's ever seen good grades. He was proud of them. He couldn't believe them, but he was proud of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was happy because he was happy.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing great.
Well, thank you. You got to put them first in life. My mm-hmm. time will come later.
And now for a word from our sponsor, the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance raises money to give research grants to inspire young researchers to work in kidney cancer and other cancers and learn how tumors grow and how we might constrain the growth of tumors and keep them from turning into metastatic disease. This is important work for cancer for everyone. Won't you please donate to the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance? Thank you. And now back to our conversation with Jim. One of the interesting aspects that has come up in the research that I've been doing on caregiving, much of it is passed down from generation to generation. And you'll hear Jim talk about the years that his grandmother spent living with his parents. What he learned about caregiving from having his grandmother in the house and what his parents learned from that experience is now being applied to his dad. And one can anticipate that in the future, that skill may be required again by the next generation. Those of us who are giving care today may one day need care, and the attitudes that we bring to that experience will help us be a better patient in the future.
I often think what an incredible role model mother is for us. And hopefully, we're remodeling things for our children.
Well, it is a beautiful thing. And role model is a good way to phrase it. What we are doing is we're paying them back for what they've done in the past.
Right.
And I know that my grandmother, my father's mother, moved to Memphis when I was about 8 years old. And she lived independent from us somewhat just down the street in a separate house, and she was able to walk around and get around, but she had to go to the store or something. Mom had to take her to the store and get her shopping for her. And then as she got older, she fell a couple of times and eventually fell one too many times and basically couldn't live on her own anymore and had to come live with us. And I watched my mother welcome her into our home. And it changed lifestyle in our home a little bit. You couldn't have radio up real loud. And I was a teenage kid and wanted to play music loud. You had to turn it down. Couldn't disturb grandma. But it was, when it came, it got to the point where grandma couldn't get back and forth from the bed to the bathroom. Mom stepped in and did what she had to do. And I saw Mom do that. And this is the next generation doing the same thing that had been done in the past.
Yeah. I was reading an AARP study about caregiving tonight. And even in 1998, there were 4 million households in the United States with at least one caregiver who's working 40 hours a week.
You know, that was the good thing about my job. I was able to retire young. It gives me more time, to help other people, whether it's volunteering here or there. You know?
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on the dynamics that existed between parents and children before and how those get recharacterized age?
That's an excellent question. I think, from what I have observed, that perhaps a person goes back to their inner self. And I am very, very fortunate that I had a father and certainly I provoked him more than he deserved it from time to time. But he was not a person that cussed a lot. He was not a bitter man. He was a happy man. He was a respectful man. I think if a person, just pardon the pun, and I don't disrespect the military in any sense in this, but if a person does cuss like a sailor when they're in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, that when they grow older and revert back to their inner self, then they're likely to cuss like a sailor. But in this man, he is a kind man. He's a respectful person, and he is a person who, even with this dementia and onset of Alzheimer's, he can be reasoned with. He's been challenging a couple of times. I've had to do this now for basically a year, and there's only been a handful of days and that he's been a little bit more irritated than most. And I know that there's psychotic drugs that can help him over some days of anxiety, and we have those available, but, you know, calming down, mild tranquilizer and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. But we don't try to use those because we don't want to basically need to escalate the dose or escalate to a stronger drug. So
mm-hmm.
if we don't need them, we don't use them. And only on a very few, maybe 5 or 6 times, have we had to give him just a little mild tranquilizer, calm him down. Normally, just soft words and kind gestures, you know.
Right.
I mean, there's days like, who are you and why are you here and what are you doing this for? And I tell him, I said, I'm doing this for you because I love you, and it's what you would have done for me. And just hug him and rub his back, and, you know, it calms him down.
Yeah.
You know, there was one day when he wanted to hit me. And I told him, I said, well, you know, if you'll feel better because you get to hit me, go ahead and hit me. But we still got to take care of these needs here, and you really don't want to hit me. I said, you never wanted to hit me before, so I don't think you really want to hit me now. It's not a challenge to him. It's just basically, I'm just here to help you, and let me help.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And did that calm him down?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it generally will calm a person down when you give them a hug and you rub their back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do. I mean, that's part of my daily routine with him. Every day I get him up and sit him on the edge of the bed while I'm getting him dressed. He gets a good back rub.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know. I don't think somebody in the nursing home, maybe will take that extra 5 or 10 minutes to just hug him and say, lean on me and let me rub your back, because he's going to sit the next 8 hours, and, you know, and vice versa in the evening. Let me rub your back. Get blood circulating back. He just about purrs like a kitten, and just enjoys it. You know
that's
he's
great.
Liking it.
Yeah.
Like rubbing the belly of a dog. Just know that he's enjoying it. And by all means, I'm not comparing my dad to a dog, for certain. I mean,
no, but I often thought that about children, you know, that if teenage years are so difficult on communication, that if you establish that kind of physical caring with a child, then you can carry it through those times when the verbal gets so difficult.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to it. I really do. I remember the most valuable advice my dad ever gave me. And I probably was about 14 years old. And he told me, he said, never, ever embarrass your mother. And you'll be all right. And I've used that so many times just to stay out of trouble.
Yeah.
And whatever it takes to keep her happy, not to embarrass her, seems always to be the right answer. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just good advice.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, as Mother says, I think we're doing the best we can.
Well, what else can you do?
That's right, and I tell her all the time that I think she's doing a marvelous job, really.
Yeah, I that's what I tell. I think, look, are you happy?
Yeah.
And that's it. Are you as happy as you can be?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And then Dad, I asked him one time, I said, Dad, are you doing okay? And he kind of shook his head no. And I said, well, are you doing as good as you can be doing? And he kind of nodded his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, then we're doing okay, aren't we? And he nodded his head, yeah. I guess one thing to encourage people to do is to get the material things that make life easy. Whether it's a lift or a chair with a table on it, remote control, minimize the complications. And if that means a little exercise routine, you know, little massage time, that, you know, little physical therapy, I think those things help extend quality as much as we could. I don't regret those things that we've tried.
Right, and things to take care of the caregiver, too.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, like the lifts and stuff like that, it saves the caregiver's backs.
And it enables
mom to get help from others. It has enabled me to get help from others because Margaret's able to help lift him up.
Mm-hmm.
I can physically pick him up, but she can't. But with a cherry picker type lift, she's able to substitute in for me when I need help. And, you know, I need vacation time and I need family time. I need to go see my kids that live out of town and grandkids that live out of town. And you know, I need to get away time. And it enables me to balance out a little responsibility with her.
Right, I think the other thing that's been wonderful is the cooperation with all the siblings.
Yeah. You know,
everybody's on the same page and everybody has the same core agenda that you've expressed here in taking care of both parents.
Yeah, right now it's most important to take care of mom.
Yes.
And make her happy. And as you well know, in all likelihood, this could go on for many years yet to come.
Yeah, we have no way to predict.
No. Whether Dad's going to be here 10 hours, 10 days, or 10 years, we don't know.
Right. Well, you're doing great, sweetie.
Well, thank you. And, you know, you just do what you got to do. You don't get to pick the cards. You just got to play what you get dealt.
You got it.
That's what we got dealt.
Right. So, thanks, and I'm glad I'm able to do little bits, even though from a distance. Mother told me today she got my packages. You know, I send her detergent and plastic bags. I'm the shopping lady.
You know, I'm proud of you and in the work that you do for so many other people and the research that you've provided, the network that you've provided. It's a great thing to be able to brag about, I guarantee you.
Well,
you know, I tell a lot of my friends, I say, yeah, when my sister started researching this thing called von Hippel-Lindau, I said, there were very few cases known in the whole country, and now it's a network she's helped put together that in dozens of countries and thousands of patients that could help. It's just amazing the work you do.
Thank you.
So thanks.
Thanks for the acknowledgement. I appreciate that. Well, thank you very much, sweetie.
Oh, you're welcome. And y'all take care.
I will.
And
you too.
I know there's people out there with bigger problems than what we've got.
That's for sure.
Many thanks to Jim and to June for all the useful pointers we've gotten today. At the beginning of this show, I asked you to think about the attitudes that we bring to this caregiving relationship, both as patients and as caregivers. And I hope that you've picked up some good pointers today. Asking the patient to do reasonable things, and as a patient, complying with the medical requests and negotiating when there may be a difference. Be sure to get the tools that you need to make life easy for the patient and for the caregiver. Things like the Hoyer lift that Jim talked about, and I'll put some information in the program guides about those kinds of resources. Next week, we're going to talk about preparing for a long-distance trip. Even if you're handicapped, even if you're in a wheelchair, you can go even on safari. And a friend of mine who's in a wheelchair and I are preparing to go to South Africa in March. So we're going to let you in on some of the planning that we have been doing to make sure that both she and I have a wonderful adventure in Africa. So I'll talk to you soon. Be well and be a powerful patient.